known each other for, just trying to work it out actually. I know we didn't speak about it when you came in, but I think we've known each other for close on 15, 16 years.
Yeah.
Going back to Chirps.
Yeah. Was it before that, or was it Chirps?
It could have been before that, because I think you came to BFM quite a few times.
Yeah,
didn't
exactly.
You? Yeah.
Exactly. So I reckon it could have been before, and at the film cinema in Soho.
That's right.
The Curzon.
Yes.
I reckon we'd have probably met there.
Yes, most probably. I'm just trying to think what screening or theatre thing it was. But anyway, at Chirps, I mentioned there at the beginning. For the uninitiated, talk to us about the process of making Chirps.
Well, I was very lucky to be asked to do it by the brilliant Colton Lee, for starters. And we hustled to try and get that made in terms of BBC money. You know, we went to all the outlets that it was quite laughable that we went to the Film Council in those days, because they really wasn't doing anything for anybody of colour then. In fact, the film industry wasn't the film industry we think of now in Britain. It was a miracle if Britain actually had a British film out, much less a black British film out. You know, it was a miracle. I mean, you could literally find that year there was 6 or 7 British films that were released. I don't know what the numbers are now, but it's a lot more. A lot more. Go. Just moving so I can fit the camera as
indeed.
Well.
Indeed. Pretend the camera's not there.
Yeah.
But yes. Okay. So yeah. So you were saying.
So Colton decided to take it upon himself to raise as much money as he could, as opposed to the budget that would make the film, and we'd do it guerrilla style, and so we shot it over, I believe, nearly a year. Sometimes we'd take 2 weeks out, sometimes we'd take a weekend, depending on what location was and how much money is managed to raise in that period of time. And it meant that there was a real gung-ho sort of everybody was in it to try and achieve something together. Unfortunately for us, the cameras that we all have now weren't available. So the idea of shooting it on video was like really frowned upon then. I mean, so like, what are you doing? You know, but we thought, Major League Colton thought that actually it's about getting our story out. It's about just telling what our lives can be, as opposed to having to fit the model of how it has to look. So obviously he tried to put as much creative endeavour and flair into making it look good, which he did, I believe. But it's, you know, had we had high definition cameras then, I think the film would have done so much better. We'd have been able to enter into a marketplace in a completely different environment.
So for first-time filmmakers, it is important, you believe, in terms of what to shoot on as opposed to getting the story out? Because you mentioned both things there.
Oh, no, I suppose, yes, but I think the real value from what Colton did is it's about us getting our stories out. I mean, we were talking before just about how the lack of documentation of black experience in Britain over the last 40 years. And I think that's because we have been waiting to be given film cameras and waiting to be given the right type of money. And we all want it to be able to fulfill a certain need, you know. And it's impossible sometimes to do that with stories that are really authentic. Because most of the time it's about, in some way, assimilating into the ideas of Western filmmaking and Hollywood and how it has to look, because we're supposed to be competing with them. But actually, I think we should compete with ourselves and compete with where we're at, so that the major thing we're trying to do is get our story out there, get our experiences out there, which I think, you know, your example is a classic example of that in terms of the film that you made. You know, you went out there and made it, and it's not about it having, you know, having 6 weeks to shoot it and all that. It's about getting the heart of our stories out there.
This is no shade you're talking about
for the audience. Which I'm sure all the audience will just know about.
But what you said is, I guess, at the crux of the matter, especially with black writers and creatives in terms of that permission kind of issue.
Exactly.
Waiting for it to be told.
Exactly.
Which brings us full circle to Soon Gone, which has been commissioned by BBC4. And I was just reading something that the head of arts said about the commission, where he talks about that it was implicit from the start that we would have a black cast and crew. This seemed like something television could do to mark the Windrush era. When you hear those comments like that, what does it say about what black creators have done for the last 40, 50 years for that to still become a talking point as opposed to it being a normal thing?
Yeah, I mean, it shows that we've got a long, long way to go. You know, for it to suddenly be deemed achievable on a project because it's talking about the Windrush, and so that's the project that suddenly the thinking has to go all the way through. You know, when they're shooting EastEnders and they're thinking, oh my gosh, let's all, you know, there must be loads and loads and loads of people from all different backgrounds on the crew as well as the cast, I think that's when the real change has happened. Whilst it's great that they're trying now, and that this has caused, and Lenny has caused people to examine more closely how the procedures they use to get crew, the procedures they use to get cast, and etc. and stories. Full stop. You know, integration. We've still got a long way to go before it's not talk and just ideas, and also there's this belief that it's somehow something that they should do, as opposed to something that just happens, it still feels as though it's a favour, as though it's a fashion. And so, you know, you have a lot of people going, oh, yeah, that's diversity. You know, well, no, actually, it's just not racism. It's not doing it to be diverse. They're doing it to stop being racist. Let's call it what it is. You know, we come up with all these nice words so it doesn't sound so painful. But what happens is, when we come up with these nice words like diversity, actually people can balk against that and go, oh, I'm not working because of diversity. Or either, you know, oh dear, so we have to do it this way because of diversity. No, you have to do it that way because you've been racist if you don't. You know what I mean? So that's what I think when I hear statements like that. It makes me really realise that we've got a long way to go.
Talk to us about your relationship with both Seleni Henry and Kwame Kweyama, who are integral to this project.
Yeah, I mean, I've known them, obviously, for a long time. Or in the case of Lenny, we've known of each other. You know, it's that thing, isn't it? You know, how close do you have to be to someone to go, yeah, I could call him my friend? You know what I mean? You know, I've had drinks with Lenny and you know, at parties and whatever, you know. Kwame, you know, we've known each other for a long, long time. And I've been a fan of his and an advocate of his for a long time. Obviously, the spelling in America, you know, makes it's difficult to keep those bonds. But now he's back, we definitely feel as though we have a connection, you know, and it's a strong connection. It's nice that it was a real honour to be picked by these two big stalwart, you know, black geniuses. They've been around for a long time and been trailblazers within this industry, regardless of their colour. You know, their ability and their efforts have been noted and recognised in the highest echelons of this industry. And it's an honour to have been chosen out of the eight to write for them.
And how did that process come about?
They just offered it to me. You know, I got a call. Do you want to do this? Me and Lenny and Lenny's company have been trying to work together for quite a while. I've got a project with them that we're trying to get off the ground. And Kwame, we've been talking about a couple of my plays to put on the Young Vic since he's been back. So, and obviously he knew about my work and directing The Big Life and the stuff I've done in The Court and things like that. So
Kingston 14.
And Kingston 14, yeah. Etc. So, you know, people have been aware of what I'm doing aside from my acting. So, yeah, I guess they thought it was a good idea, which I'm very pleased about.
And talk to us about the episode that you've written for this broadcast.
I don't want to give it away. But what I can say is mine's about a young boy, obviously West Indian, but a black British West Indian, I born here. And it's a journey into the issues facing a 16-year-old in the 60s. Well, I should say late 60s, and how he circumvents the world around him and how that affects who he is. And I think that's something that is hard for people to grapple with, is how much the outside world affects our personality. It affects our choices. It affects how we live day to day, the difference being a minority is so palpable at that age. I mean, I think it is whatever age you are, really. But when you're really trying to find who you are, when you look back at yourself at 16, you realise that actually I was cutting off that point of my personality, so I didn't have to deal with that, or I was exposing this side of myself so that I could get through that thing. And if those things weren't in the way, I wouldn't have grown to be the person I am. So it's I suppose it's how it makes us think. It's not necessarily, most things are about what we do. And what I'm trying to talk about in this particular piece is how life around us has made him think and think of himself and apportion only a certain space in life to be able to exist in because of the outside world.
How personal is Windrush to you?
How personal is the monologues of Windrush?
I guess it's a two-part question. The monologues, which is obviously what's going out on telly, and the day-to-day kind of narrative of Windrush with what's happened over the past 12 months.
Well, it's a complete slight on my existence here, the things that have happened. Well, hey, look, it wasn't over the last 12 months. I actually, you know, tried to get a news article to do a news documentary about what was happening about 3 years ago.
Right.
And it wasn't deemed a sexy enough story to be interested in. What happened, particularly in the last 12 months, was there was a groundswell of of cases. This has been going on for such a long time. It's just that there was too many of for the media and for everyone to ignore. You know, there were cases of whole planes of old OAP West Indians landing in Jamaica with no passport, nothing, with two suitcases, just being flung out of England after living here for 50-odd years. And the Jamaicans are like, well, what are we meant to do with you? We don't even really know if we can classify you as Jamaican. You've been in Britain for so long, and you've just been sent over. You know, that was where, how the story, that was the angle of the story when I first remember it, was the Jamaican government being like, well, what are we meant to do with them? We're not even really sure we can consider them Jamaican. They haven't been here for 60, 70 years. You know, they haven't been back. You know, it's like, why are they suddenly our responsibility? And where are we meant to house them? They haven't got all their families back in Jamaica. So how are we meant to house them? That was how I first heard the story, you know. So it's just an indictment of how our stories aren't felt as important as everybody else's. That's the feeling that it leaves me with. This last 12 months has made me feel that actually we're not valued. We're fetishized. Completely fetishized.
It's a strong word.
You know, our music, our fashions, all that, you know. Oh, yeah, they'll take that. But the normal life of a West Indian, the normal people that come here and, you know, drive the buses and do all the, you know, do all the normal great work that normal people do, good people do, valuable citizens do, actually that stuff is just not heralded as something to be celebrated. That was part of when I did The Big Life. Not only were people saying they didn't recognize that as a history that they were told, they were also saying, oh my God, it's amazing to see something that is actually celebrating black people. Sorry, not black people, celebrating West Indians. Because they just all thought that all black people in England were immigrants and have no connection to the mother country, in inverted commas, into the Commonwealth, and are subscribing to neocolonialism. You know, they just didn't. It didn't really seem to connect with the narrative that they'd been taught at school or what they're hearing in newspapers. You know, the Windrush story is still new to people, which is insane. It's insane. You know, it was a British colony. My parents came over here with a British passport.
Right.
So to be then told, oh, you have to go back because you're not British, is an insanity. You know, well, insanity. Is it an insanity? I think a lot of the time it's just that they're not really taught the truth. So they don't actually really understand the connection. That they can't suddenly break the connection and think that there isn't rights on both sides.
Did your parents ever relay to you what they truly felt about that experience?
Well, funny enough, my parents, well, obviously, well, my parents went back to Jamaica. And what's it? I think it's nearly a decade ago they went back to Jamaica. But the majority of their life has been here. You know, all the tax money that they've ever earned, it's been here. They were too young to work in Jamaica, so they all came. Every penny that, near enough, every penny they've earned has gone into Britain in terms of tax. You know, they paid their dues. You know, and in a way, there's a contradiction in what I'm saying now, because I'm not really accepting that actually the Britain that the Jamaica they grew up in was under British rule. You know, when they tell stories of when a teacher, when at the beginning of the day, they'd sing the national anthem. So it's that really weird scenario where they're more British than the people that live in Britain. And because these stories haven't been relayed, because this history hasn't been told, I think that people have a different understanding of the people that they are supposedly having to get used to. Well, we were having to get used to you for a lot longer, actually, you know. And it's not payback. It's symbiotic. This is how it has to be, you know. The country is making a fortune out of immigration. You know, that's why it was never talked about for ages as a problem, because the numbers, they needed the numbers so that they were making enough money and they were getting the workers that could work for a certain level of pay. That's the interchange. That's how it works. To suddenly think you can just separate yourself from it, or to think that they don't have the same rights as you do, is just not to understand how you know, globalization, neocolonialism, etc. actually works. We're completely linked in it. You can't suddenly take yourself out of it. The good stuff and the bad stuff are linked to.
Yeah. How do you think audiences will receive Soon Gone?
I don't know. I think they'll like it. I mean, I think it's undoubtedly a provocation. It's undoubtedly unsettling. It's not something that is just, you know, oh, look, we were here and we're still here. Whee! It's definitely not that. It's a provocation. It's something for us all to have to grapple with and look at ourselves and wonder how we proceed. It's not something that, it's not something that has a end date in perception. By that I mean that the impact of, just like our impact here is ongoing, I think the way that the arc of the story and the stories that we're telling inside it, that it undoubtedly will make us think of the future of West Indies here, not just what we have done up until today. It's undoubtedly questioning our own sense of self, our own validity, our own sense of our future here.
You talk about provocation not having an end date, and that's something that's very apparent in Sus, which is a film that you did with Rafe Spall and Ralph Brown, and was directed by Rob Heath. And I remember you telling me at the time, or was it Rob was telling me at the time, that the film came about because of what happened to Stephen Lawrence.
Yeah. So did it come about? Yes, I suppose. What happened was, obviously the play was done originally in the 1970s.
That's right, Long Good Friday.
Yeah,
from the writer
Barry Keefe, who wrote Long Good Friday, and it was a very successful play. And what happened was Philip Headley, from Theatre Royal Stratford East, when Stephen Lawrence was murdered, decided, let's put this play on as a reflection of what has been before and what clearly is still happening in today's society. And that was 1993
he died, and then the trial was 1999.
Blimey, is that long ago?
So
we put it on like the it would have been 6 months after, something like that,
right?
The most a year after. We had Stephen Lawrence do a talk after. Sorry, we had his dad,
Neville
do a talk afterwards with his lawyer, etc.
Right.
And it was done in Greenwich, so it was Stratford East production, but we tried to get as close to South London as possible. So it's at the Greenwich Theatre, or Greenwich Theatre. And Rob came to see me in it.
Right.
Then. And it stuck with him as such a powerful moral piece of work, or a strong telling of an unmoral case. And I was then offered it again 10 years later, I think it was, roughly, by Bola Hanna Beeson at the Young Vic. And I was on the phone to Rob's hour, being offered that again. You know, yeah, I can't see how I'm going to say no. And me and Rob have been trying to make films for ages. And he was expressing how much he loved it, the play. And it just came, you know, literally in a 10, 15 minute conversation. You know, what are you doing? Oh, I'm thinking I'm going to do Sus again. Oh, yeah, you know. Yeah, that would make a great film. Yeah, I guess it, yeah. Yeah, it would, wouldn't it? Well, if we can't make that, it's three people in a room. Yeah, yeah. Well, shall we just do it? Because I could get blah, 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 and you could get blah, 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 and we could do that. I know Jono, he knows them. Yeah, well, shall we see if we could do it? Shall I just ring up Barry? And this is before we went in, even I went into rehearsals to make the play. And literally within about 6 weeks, we were going to be doing it. It was on. We would cast it, everything. It was on. We're doing it. So I'd finished. I was going into rehearsals, say about 3 weeks after that phone call. Month rehearsal, performed it. While I was performing, we were doing all the prep. And as soon as it's like 2 weeks after I finished doing the play, we made the film. And it was just one of those things where the timing was right. Everything came together for some reason. It all became really, really possible really, really quickly. And so, yeah, we made it. We made it.
And how proud are you of
that film? Yeah, no, I'm really, really proud of it. As a response to try and keep the conversation going about black people's experience here. Obviously, it's about the police in that respect, but it's really about our experience, and that experience may happen to one person, but 100 people feel the ramifications of that, and that's what I don't think we're able to put across enough, that those experiences of the few really have a profound effect on all of us that live here, that have to engage with the police, that have to engage with racism, that have to get engaged with microaggressions. All those things take its toll on our mental health. And in the other project that I'm doing, which is it's called The Happy Tragedy of Being Woke, that I'm doing with Complicité, the genius Simon McBurney. On February the 8th, we're doing a showing of it, which is free at the Tobenby Hall. And we're going to put online. That is a story where I'm really trying to talk about the mental health of someone that is actually grappling with all the things that happen to us as a community, as opposed to what is just happening to him. So he has his own stuff, but the idea of being woke obviously is about understanding the political ramifications of what happens to us as a society. And how that can impact on how we interface with everything around us. You can't suddenly turn the light off once you've exposed the horrible truths of things. How do you then just walk and live in the world without it colouring how you think? And so I'm using cross-cultural adoption as a way into that conversation.
How important is it for you as a West Indian to be documenting these experiences with SARS, the big life, now with soon gone? How important is it?
It's everything, really. I mean, I suppose as an artist...
Would you say it was your calling?
My calling? As an artist, all I want to do is reflect how we live. Whether that's, you know, whether that's white people, black people, blah, 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 blah. Obviously, I have a stronger affinity with being black. So it's easier to tell that story, or I have a stronger desire to tell that story. I recently made a short film about a Jewish woman and an American white man. You know, so it's not something that is carte blanche and that's all I'm ever going to write or do. It's more about the point that I'm trying to make. And maybe most of the points I'm trying to make are around black culture. I think my calling is to tell stories or to be part of stories. So I've got a lot of friends who'd be laughing their head off right now because they would say, "Shut up, Clint, you know, you're too political. You're always going on about it, blah, 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 blah." You know, so maybe in some respects there's a side of me that that does want to get a representation out of us that I think is fair and even and deliberate and truthful. You know, the honesty is the complexity of our experience is what I'd really like to get out. I don't think it's as simple as, oh, we got stopped by the police and then they beat us up and then we were okay and then the story ends. You know, I think there's you know, I think that used to be where the story could end, and we were grateful for that. But I actually think there's a deeper analysis that should be happening now. I think what our experience has moved on from what they do to us. We need to be talking about what we do to ourselves because of that experience. Do you see what I mean? And I think that we haven't been in control of the type of stories that are being told about us. And so there's been a reliance on headline stories. So... you know, things that are the headlines of newspapers. Oh, right, let's tell that story because that, you know, that's in a newspaper. I'd love to see more, I want to work better word than normal, but more everyday, where we make the everyday extraordinary, yeah, as opposed to extraordinary stories about our community, you know? I think that's what's really been missing, you know, where something, and I don't necessarily mean gentle, I just mean more honest, just and more everyday experience, you know. what 2% of the black community involving crime, you know what I mean? Yeah, every story's crime related, yeah. you know what I mean? It's like, you know, I'm not saying that they're, you know, we don't have a problem with young kids, you know, I'm really not saying that at all. But I think there's an argument that the problem is for the young kids is that that's the only representation they see of themselves. So they think that's what they're meant to be doing. You know, the music industry has helped fuel this image of our young people, and we're so much more.
Yeah. Now, as an actor and a creative, you never retire. You're always kind of carrying on. Mm. 40 years from now, do you see yourself settling here or back in the Caribbean?
Back in the Caribbean. Listen, man, I was born here. Me as an English man. You know, that's the irony. That's the irony. Yeah. You know, say I'm going to go to the Caribbean, you know, back to Jamaica. You know, it's kind of bizarre. You know, I can't, obviously I go back, my parents are there, you know, but where I see myself dying, which I think is what you're...
I was being kind.
bringing me closely to, thank you very much. So, where do you think you'll die, Clint? A great interview. Thanks. where am I going to die? I don't know. I can't imagine that I'd have to make a real shed load of money to be able to just go, yeah. I mean, I just pick up myself and go back to Mandeville and build a house. In some mansion.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's, I think money, you know, I got two kids and I suppose that's where my focus is really. I have a feeling that I might be where my kids are.
Right.
I think that's, an important thing to recognize. I think that actually, I think that's where it will be. I'll be trying to be as close to my kids.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there. Click there. Right. Thank you very much.
Lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much.
No problem.